From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, weekend one of the Coachella Festival delivered plenty of onstage viral moments. What about the music? And then, my visit to Mitchell Froom's recording studio. He's produced records for nearly 40 years with artists such as Randy Newman and Bonnie Raitt, and he reflects on how the industry has changed.
If you get a really great track, but there was a bad part in it, you know, I remember like someone at Elvis Costello would say, oh, just put a tambourine over it, it'd be fine, you know?
And a program that provides mentors from Hollywood for teen girls aspiring to writing careers. All that coming up on The Frame. The Coachella Festival just wrapped up its first of two weekends with headline performances from Ariana Grande, Childish Gambino, and Tame Impala. While more and more pop music continues to creep into a festival originally created to spotlight indie rock, Coachella is also casting a wider net when it comes to booking artists from around the globe. Blackpink became the first K-pop girl group to play Coachella, and LA Times pop music critic Michael Wood says Latino performers like Los Tucanes de Tijuana and Rosalía were some of the biggest crowd pleasers of the festival. But he says his overall Coachella experience left a bit to be desired.
Coachella has really turned into a festival that seems optimized for YouTube. So many times when I was watching shows this weekend, I got the sense that what they were thinking about was who was watching at home. Now, that manifests in a lot of different ways. Childish Gambino, for instance, put on a performance that was musically not great, but had some incredible camera work. He had a camera, like guys with steady cams kind of following him around into the crowd, composing these amazing, like beautiful shots that then they put on the big screens at Coachella. But you're standing on the field looking up at these screens and you're sort of wondering, why did I come to the desert to look at a big screen that I could watch at home?
Well, this has been a dilemma not only at Coachella, but at large concerts everywhere. But in this case, how was that moment and similar moments where an artist is trying to create a viral moment, how was that typically received by the audience?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. It's not about being in the moment or trying to give a performance that really connects with the people in front of you. It's about what can we do to make this thing gain some traction online. Now, that's not necessarily the worst thing in the world. Weezer brought out Chili from TLC and Tears for Fears to do two of the songs they cover on their Teal album. And that was kind of funny. I mean, that was a funny way to look at an old rock guitar band that otherwise had no business at modern Coachella. So, you know, kind of got a kick out of that. But other times it felt desperate. I mean, Kacey Musgraves, who I love, at some point in her show, for some unknown reason, she brought out this old Instagram celebrity, this woman who I'm not personally familiar with, but it had nothing to do with anything. It was clearly just a moment to get people tweeting, retweeting, Instagramming. It made no sense. I didn't understand it.
Well, Coachella, I think, can still be a great opportunity to discover a band you know, you'd never heard of, or a performer you maybe never saw live before. What were some, if any, standouts for you in that regard?
It's true. It's true. You know, I sort of bag on the big marquee things and whether or not they're going in a good direction. But there are always other good things happening at Coachella. This year, I really enjoyed Sophie, who is an electronic producer. She had this performance that felt like such a interesting critique of the sort of EDM experience. She was basically just standing completely still behind her, you know, laptop or whatever, while these huge, distorted sledgehammer beats were playing. And she was totally resisting the classic sort of like getting the crowd pumped up thing. And then like right after her, Diplo played in the big dance Sahara tent, which is exactly that sort of like, hey, are you with me type thing. So that was a funny sort of contrast that I enjoyed. Billie Eilish was also definitely an interesting thing to see. This is a young LA native singer who's gotten a lot of attention in the media in the past few weeks, big hit record. And so I was interested at Coachella to sort of see, is this thing for real? Is this like kind of a media narrative that here's the America's newest pop star?
Right.
Or is this someone who is truly connecting with an audience? And I'm here to tell you, she's truly connecting with an audience.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy, just can't get enough guy, chest always on.
She was pretty late. I don't know if there was a technical problem or whatever, but you know, nobody's really late at Coachella because they've got this live stream. So she was about 30 to 40 minutes late, and people stood there and waited. They wanted to see Billie that bad that was okay. And once she came on stage, you could just like feel the excitement in the crowd.
Now, going into weekend two, there are people who will be going for the first time who were not there for weekend one. Any words of advice for them?
My advice is just try to have an experience that is in the moment. I mean, so much of the festival seems like it's being directed off-site. But one of the beautiful things about Coachella, when it's beautiful, is that you've got 100,000-ish people gathered because they really love music, or maybe they like music and they love Instagram. And they're trying to have a good time. And when it works, it works.
Michael Wood is pop music critic for the LA Times. Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Good to be here.
And one news update from Hollywood. This weekend, the contract between the Writers Guild of America and the Association of Talent Agencies expired. The writers want agencies to sign a code of conduct that relates to fees that agents make from packaging production deals. With no agreement in place, writers are being encouraged to fire their agents. The Frame's John Horn gives us a little insight on what all this might mean.
I don't think it's going to have any immediate impact on production in any realm. I mean, a lot of these shows are already staffed, and according to the Writers Guild, if you have fired your agent, you can bring in a manager or a lawyer to negotiate your deal. The Writers Guild believes that. The talent agents say that's a violation of law, and they're going to hire a law firm to fight that. A lot of writers I've talked to say that they don't really need their agents to get work anyway. You can find your own stuff on social media. You can get a recommendation from a friend. So the revenue that could be lost will be to the talent agents. And the writers themselves say that they may be getting a 10% raise.
Coming up on The Frame, a visit to producer Mitchell Froom's home studio, where he's recorded many top artists, including Randy Newman. Mitchell Froom has been the go-to producer collaborator for a host of legendary artists, Randy Newman, Elvis Costello, Bonnie Raitt, and Los Lobos, to name a few. But Froom's early days were actually in the spotlight as a keyboardist and songwriter in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1970s. But Froom prefers the studio, one that these days is also jammed with his collection of vintage keyboards and synthesizers, including the Celeste, used on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood to create the sound of Trolley.
And I don't know how exactly they do it, but the train, remember that?
Froom still writes and records his own music, too. Releases, though, are rare. But earlier this month, he put out two distinctly different albums, one called Ether, featuring a rotating cast of vocalists, and Monkey Tree, a more experimental electronic-based collection created with his studio partner, David Boucher. For our interview, Froom and I settled in behind his mixing console, where he had just wrapped up recording sessions for Rufus Wainwright's forthcoming album.
Well, we just finished last week, which was an epic undertaking. We spent almost a year and a half.
Wow. Epic in terms of what exactly?
Everything. His singing, his writing, wow. His vocal arrangements, and working with him was just a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was open-minded and at the same time had a tremendous amount of ideas. So in a situation like that, I just look for where I feel I can be helpful. It's trying to make sure that an overabundance of ideas work really well together. So,
got it.
And it, what's interesting is that it wouldn't work well for anyone but him.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And well, it's the same with Randy Newman. Now, his arrangements are incredible, but those same arrangements wouldn't work really well for a different artist because it's just part of who he is and what mm-hmm. he is. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you're also, of course, a very skilled musician. And I'm wondering, like, early on in this career of yours, like, at what point did it seem that production was really going to be the direction you went to, as opposed to being in a full-time band?
I realized that I thought I had more going on musically and more understanding than a lot of the people that were hiring me. So I started seeing, well, it's possible I could do it. I never dreamed I could do it. I was in awe of the George Martins of the world, you know. Mm-hmm. And I, just through a weird set of circumstances, I got to produce my first band, and then it just happened. My first solo record was basically a reworked soundtrack to an art porn movie called Café Flesh. And Slash Records agreed. They wanted
LA,
to put it out.
Yeah. LA punk label.
And then the second band I worked with was Crowded House. Mm-hmm. And so then that started. All of a sudden, I guess I was a record producer.
But you've also continued to put out music, not very often. You have
two
new collections out now. Why do you only put something out every, you know, I don't know, decade?
I do it when I feel I have to. Usually, like, for example, I have an EP and a long-form mm-hmm. record, which are both totally different. But the long-form record is all analog synthesizers and
it's
Chamberlains.
Ether.
Yeah. And I'd written this piece of music, and I thought, well, why don't I just try to orchestrate it? Because I work every day on music on something. So I just, whenever I had time, I just went to it. And I got really excited about doing it. It was extremely difficult, but maybe that's what made me excited about it.
What was difficult about it?
A lot is done one note at a time. It just took a lot of time. 5 seconds a day or something is the most I could ever get. So in Ether, I really got away from any kind of beaded out time, except on a few songs where someone was playing a guitar. There's no like click tracks or anything that was holding that. So it's right. I wanted it to just feel really open, more conducted than sort of groove feeling, which also made it much more difficult.
Did you have the songs in your head, if you will, and then it was a matter of trying to get the right execution? Or
mostly I would write out the tunes and the harmony. Then I would go in and try to orchestrate that. It was just a lot of experimenting. For me, that kind of project, it really helps me in my job mm-hmm. because I now have a million ideas of things when I'm dealing with a song. I say, I've got all these techniques I've developed. So, for example, there's one song on Rufus Wainwright's record that is all, it's him at the piano, and then it's all synths, and I use a little drum machine. So I got to bring that to his music in a different way.
Right. Some of the knowledge you were getting with the experimentation.
Yeah, so I gave me the confidence. And he heard it, and he had just written this new song that was kind of funny. And he said, well, why don't you just... And we were sort of out of money. He said, well, why don't you just do one of those synth things? Try that and see how that goes.
Uh-huh. You know? You have to, given the longevity of your career, you constantly have to be up to speed with different technologies,
and
what you can do with instruments.
And just ideas for people.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's hopefully with each artist, you can understand them on a deep level and help develop music that sounds unique to them. And that's not easy. You can't just say, oh, I've got this one way that I work, and now this is how we're going to do the bass and drums and the guitars, and then it'll be fine. Because it worked on this other guy's record. No, not at all. Everyone's so different.
We're here in the studio with producer Mitchell Froom, and he's got two new records out. One is called Ether, and the other is called Monkey Tree. We hear a number of different vocalists on Ether, including Pete Molinari and Kat Edmondson, and this veteran Russian rock singer.
He found me through Richard Thompson.
Oh.
He's He's in this legendary Russian band called Aquarium. He said they used to just play in tiny apartments, and then all of a sudden, with the fall of communism, all of a sudden he was playing stadiums. He's really famous with on his own. His name is Boris Grebenshchikov.
Right.
I think he goes by BG now. He's as much of a star as anybody I've ever worked with in my life. I love this guy. Yeah. In this case, this piece that's on here was one section of a three-part piece of music he had on one of the records we did.
Mm.
And I just asked him, hey, could I just take your vocal and your guitar and just create this completely different thing?
I see. Well, tell me what Boris thought of the finished product.
He said it was fine.
What are some of the things that have really changed technology-wise, recording-wise, in the studio? I mean, how much different of a place is the studio today?
It's just a different time. And what's gone that makes me the saddest is the amount that I learned being in on sessions from different people, listening, you know, just the amount I learned from Jim Keltner or Pete Thomas or David Hidalgo. Like, it was much more of a kind of community where you could really learn. And now people are facing just themselves at home. It's just different. I can't really explain it. And in some scenes, I know some people are working in a way where they have like a community and they can do stuff together. It feels different to me. Mm. It feels more isolated. And I hear a lot of things on the radio and it just sounds like one guy at home just kind of like putting it together. Like, you know, you've worked on this a little too much or beat the life out of it.
Have that. I know what you mean. And
Electricity or whatever you want to say.
Whatever that X factor, whatever they call it, that you would have with a band.
Yeah. And if you get a really great track, but there was a bad part in it, you know, I remember like someone at Elvis Costello would say, oh, just put a tambourine over it and be fine. You know, like just that kind of thinking. Like,
yeah.
Not like, okay, well, let me get in here and I'm going to fix this and then I'm going to copy it, and then it's going to appear like this every single time. And, you know, those things are flattening elements. And people are so used to everything being perfectly in time and perfectly in tune. If you start to completely tune a vocal so it's perfectly in tune, you're going to lose a lot.
So what's coming around the pike, do you think? I mean,
I don't know. They're everything. That's the thing now. Someone said there's something like 1 million recordings coming out every year. What I like is that all bets are off. Like in the 80s when I started producing, there was, you know, 6 reverbs on the snare drum. There was all these things that would happen that were part of the sound of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was like after Nirvana came out, everything had to be like below middle C. It just had to be deep and low. Anything above that sounded corny. But now you can do anything.
That's producer Mitchell Froom. His new records are Ether and Monkey Tree. And Mitchell, thanks for letting us come into your studio and bother you for a little while.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, a program that provides mentors from Hollywood for teen girls aspiring to write for a living. There's a mentoring program in Hollywood called Write Girl. That's Write with a W. That pairs actors and writers with teen girls. At a recent star-studded event, a few prominent actors brought some of the teen stories to life. KPCC's arts education reporter Carla Javier takes us there.
There's a space off Vine Street called the Linwood Dunn Theater. It's very Hollywood. There are these giant, like bigger-than-life-sized Oscar statuettes that flank hallways lined with behind-the-scenes photos of Hollywood hits. In one of those hallways, I meet 18-year-old Sam from East L.A.
I'm a Write Girl. I've been a Write Girl for 6 seasons.
Sam is referring to a free L.A.-based program called Write Girl. That's W-R-I-T-E. It's for aspiring writers like her, ages 13 to 18, who are looking for guidance from women writers who volunteer to share their expertise. Write Girl pairs hundreds of teen girls with professionals for workshops and one-on-one mentoring. The teen girls are at a vulnerable stage in their life, so Right Girl asked us not to use their full names. Every month, Right Girl offers sessions focused on different aspects of writing. And Sam is here in this glamorous space owned by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences because at the last workshop in character and dialogue, the Right Girls wrote scripts. And now the organization has arranged for actors to take those stories from the page to the stage. And Sam's hoping her script gets chosen.
That's very exciting. Just fingers crossed I get something in there.
This event helps the organization raise enough money to help the teens. And it's also a chance for them to see their work interpreted by professionals. And not just any professionals, but a star-studded cast. This time, actors like Keiko Agena from Gilmore Girls, Kirby Howell-Baptiste, Wayne Brady, and Seth Rogen are bringing the girls' writing to life. The actors perform 14 of the scripts, including Sam's. Here's Howell-Baptiste reading a monologue Sam wrote.
Seriously, how easy does he think this is? Stab, stab, you dead. No. You see, my job takes precision. I have to track the dragon down, find the lair, hide out, and go through this whole process.
We're like this scene, written by 17-year-old Rachel, where Keiko Agena plays a student who's excited she got into her dream college until she notices something on her acceptance letter.
My dedication to athleticism and commitment to water polo. Water polo, I don't even know how to swim.
A panel of female screenwriters give feedback on the scripts. Like on that last one, producer and screenwriter Josanne McGibbon, known for Runaway Bride and Desperate Housewives, has this to say.
One thing that's so hard to do that you did is really take us on such a journey.
The show's hosted by actor and New York Times bestseller Lauren Graham. This is her first year as a Right Girl mentor herself.
Being creative, being playful, having fun, finding your voice, I wish I'd had that at a younger age.
We caught up after the show, and she told me she mentors with Right Girl because she believes it's important for teen girls in particular to find their voice.
That can only be positive for the creative world, for the political world, for the world.
Let's talk about that for a second, the creative world. In TV, women writers represented just 25% of the writers on broadcast network shows, according to a 2018 study from the Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film at San Diego State. And in film, the stats are even more dismal. Women writers represented just 15% of all writers on last year's top 100 films. It's something Victoria, who comes to Right Girl from the Valley, says she thinks about. I caught up with her by the red carpet after the show.
We have too many of the same stories, which, you know, not to invalidate anyone's experiences, but new stories need to be told.
She's just 14 years old, and this is her first year with Right Girl. Her script got chosen, too.
I heard, like, the names Alex and Diane, which are the characters in the story, and I, like, freaked out, and I turned to her, and I was like, oh, my God, Mom, like, Seth Rogen and Wendy, and I was, like, freaking out and everything.
In her scene, the characters are getting ready for a party when Alex, played by Rogen, has something to get off his chest.
I know you don't get it, and you've lived your whole life not, you know, having to tug at your shirt to make sure your stomach wasn't bulging out, and you've never had to wear massive hoodies to hide your hideous body, and you can walk into a mall and not feel the changing room stalls closing in on you and taunting you for not fitting in a suit. And I'm glad you don't, and I hope you never do, because it's soul-crushing, and I love you, and I wouldn't ever want you to experience something like that.
Seth delivered the lines a little bit differently than what I had imagined, but I actually found it to be a lot more, like, moving, the way that it was so, like, honest.
During the panel discussion, writer, actor, and director Lauren Miller Rogen had this to say about Victoria's work.
The bravery that a writer can have in putting some of those really raw emotions in a scene can be so rewarding to the people who are enjoying your material.
Victoria says she was thrilled to get this kind of feedback on her first real script.
Oh my goodness, like, if you're telling me that this is good, like, maybe I can actually, like, make something out of this.
That is kind of the point, says Right Girls founder and executive director Karen Taylor.
They have a lot of potential. If you work with them when they're young, before they get that idea that it's unattainable or they get doors closed on them.
She says that's one of the reasons why they host this event with the Academy in their building.
You just get this feeling like you're part of this whole lineage of film writers. I'm not at school anymore. I'm not at a community center. I'm right here in Hollywood with Hollywood writers that are going to help me do this.
Next month, the girls take on creative nonfiction by writing memoir. The audio of the performances is courtesy of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. For The Frame, I'm Carla Javier.
And speaking of writing, the Pulitzer Prize for Drama was awarded today to Jackie Sibley's Drury for her play Fairview. The prize for music was given to composer Ellen Reed for Prism, which had its world premiere last fall here in L.A., and a posthumous special citation was awarded to Aretha Franklin. That's all for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. John is back here tomorrow.